or cherished schemes. Those who are always ready to look upon misfortune as a crime would be greatly surprised if they knew the pains I have taken all my life through to prevent anyone being able to say to me with truth, in time of my misfortune, "You have well deserved it." The relinquishment of this work left me for some time undecided as to what I should undertake next, and this interval of idleness was my ruin, since it gave me time to direct my thoughts towards myself, for lack of anything outside to claim my attention. I no longer had any schemes for the future to amuse my imagination. It was not even possible for me to form any, since my present situation was exactly that in which all my desires were united. I could imagine no more, and yet my heart was still conscious of a void. My condition was the more cruel, as I saw none that could be preferred to it. I had centred my tenderest affections upon a person after my own heart, who returned it. I lived with her without restraint, and, so to say, as I pleased. Nevertheless, a secret feeling of oppression never left me, whether I was with her or away from her. While possessing her, I felt that she was still not mine, and the mere idea that I was not all in all to her caused her to seem hardly anything to me. I had friends of both sexes to whom I was attached by the purest friendship and the most perfect esteem. I counted upon the truest return of these feelings on their part, and it never occurred to me ever once to doubt their sincerity. Yet this friendship was more painful to me than agreeable, owing to their obstinacy, even their affectation, in opposing all my inclinations, tastes, and manner of life. It was enough for me to seem to desire anything which concerned myself alone, and which did not depend upon them, in order to see them all immediately combine to force me to renounce it. This obstinate desire to control me absolutely in all my fancies, which was the more unjust, as, far from attempting to control theirs, I did not even take the trouble to make myself acquainted with them, became so cruelly burdensome to me that at last I never received a letter from them without feeling, when I opened it, a certain alarm, which was only too well justified by the perusal of it. I thought that, in the case of people who were all younger than myself, and who all stood in sore need themselves of the good advice which they lavished upon me, it was treating me too much like a child. "Love me," said I to them, "as I love you. As for the rest, do not interfere with my affairs any more than I interfere with yours. That is all I ask of you." If they have granted me one of these two requests, it has certainly not been the latter. I had a retired abode in a charming solitude, master within my own four walls. I could live there in my own fashion, without being subject to anyone's control. But this abode imposed upon me certain duties, which were pleasant to fulfil, but indispensable. My liberty was altogether precarious, in a position of greater subjection than if I had been under orders. I could not help being so by inclination. When I got up, I could never once say to myself, "I will spend this day as I please." Besides being dependent on Madame d'Epinay's arrangements, I still had a more importunate claim upon me, that of the public and chance visitors. The distance of my residence from Paris did not prevent the daily arrival of crowds of idlers, who, not knowing what to do with their own time, wasted mine without the slightest scruple. When I least expected it, I was mercilessly assailed, and I rarely made agreeable plans for spending the day without finding them upset by the arrival of some unexpected visitor. In short, amidst the blessings which I had most eagerly longed for, finding no pure enjoyment, I returned by fits and starts to the unclouded days of my youth, and I sometimes cried with a sigh to myself, "Ah, this is not Les Charmettes." The recollections of the different periods of my life led me to reflect upon the point which I had reached, and I saw myself, already in my declining years, a prey to painful evils, and believed that I was approaching the end of my career, without having enjoyed in its fullness scarcely one single pleasure of those for which my heart yearned, without having given scope to the lively feelings which I felt it had in reserve, without having tasted or even sipped that intoxicating pleasure which I felt was in my soul in all its force, and which, for want of an object, always found itself kept in check, and unable to give itself vent in any other way but through my sighs. How came it to pass that I, a man of naturally expansive soul, for whom to live was to love, had never yet been able to find a friend entirely devoted to myself, a true friend, I, who felt admirably adapted to be one myself? How came it to pass that, with feelings so easily set on fire, with a heart full of affection, I had never once been inflamed with the love of a definite object? Consumed by the desire of loving, without ever having been able to satisfy it completely, I saw myself approaching the portals of old age, and dying without having lived. These melancholy but touching reflections caused me to turn my thoughts towards myself with a regret which was not without its pleasure. It seemed to me that destiny owed me something which had not yet granted me. Why had I been born with delicate faculties, if they were to remain unemployed to the end? The consciousness of my inner value, while calling forth the feeling of having been unfairly depreciated, in some degree compensated for it, and caused me to shed tears, which it was a pleasure to me to allow to flow. I pursued these reflections in the most beautiful season of the year, in the month of June, in cool groves, amidst the song of the nightingale and the purling of brooks. Everything combined to plunge me again into that too seductive indolence, to which I was naturally inclined, but from which the hard and austere frame of mind, to which a long period of inner ferment had brought me, should have delivered me once and for all. Unhappily, I went on to recall the dinner at the Chateau of Thun, and my meeting with those two charming girls at the same season of the year, and in a spot almost like that where I was at the moment. This recollection, rendered still more charming by the breath of innocence which pervaded it, brought back others of the same kind. Presently I saw gathered round me all the objects which had touched my heart with emotion during my youth. Mademoiselle Galli, Mademoiselle de Graffenried, Mademoiselle de Bray, Madame Basile, Madame de Lanage, my young pupils, even the Picon Zulietta, whom my heart can never forget. I saw myself surrounded by a seraglio of houris, and by my old acquaintances, the liveliest desire for whom was no new sensation for me. My blood became heated and inflamed, my head swam, in spite of my hairs already growing grey. And the serious citizen of Geneva, the austere Jean-Jacques, close upon his 45th year, suddenly became again the love-sick shepherd. The intoxication which seized me, although so sudden and extravagant, was notwithstanding so strong and lasting that nothing less than the unforeseen and terrible crisis of the unhappiness into which it plunged me would have been able to cure me of it. However, this intoxication, to whatever point it was carried, did not go so far as to make me forget my age and my position, flatter me with the idea that I could still inspire love, or make me attempt to communicate this devouring but barren fire by which from childhood I felt my heart in vain consumed. I did not hope, I did not even desire it. I knew that the time for love was over. I was too keenly conscious of the ridicule heaped upon elderly beaux to expose myself to it, and I was not the man to become presumptuous and self-confident in my declining years, after having so rarely displayed such qualities during my best days. Besides, as a friend of peace, I should have dreaded domestic storms, and I loved Thérèse too sincerely to expose her to the annoyance of seeing me entertain livelier feelings for others than those with which she herself inspired me. What did I do on this occasion? The reader must have already guessed, if he has hitherto followed me with the least attention. The impossibility of grasping realities threw me into the land of chimeras, and, seeing nothing in existence which was worthy of my enthusiasm, I sought nourishment for it in an ideal world, which my fertile imagination soon peopled with beings after my own heart. This resource was never so welcome to me or so fruitful. In my continued ecstasies, I intoxicated myself with full draughts of the most delightful sensations that have ever entered the heart of man. I entirely forgot the human race, and created for myself societies of perfect beings, heavenly alike in their beauties and virtues, trusty, tender, and loyal friends, such as I never found in this world below. I found such pleasure in soaring into the Empyrean, in the midst of the charming objects by which I was surrounded, that I passed the hours and days in it without taking count of them, and forgetting everything else. No sooner had I hastily eaten a morsel of food than I burned to escape, in order to run to my groves again. When ready to set out for my world of enchantment, if I saw some wretched mortals arrive who came to keep me back upon earth, I was unable to conceal or restrain my annoyance, and, losing control over myself, I gave them so rude a reception that it might almost have been called brutal. This only increased my reputation as a misanthrope, whereas it would have gained for me a very different one if the world had read my heart better. At the height of my greatest exaltation, I was suddenly pulled back like a kite by the string, and restored to my place by nature, assisted by a smart attack of my complaint. I employed the only remedy which afforded me relief, that is to say, the bougies, which put a stop to my celestial amours. For besides that a man is seldom amorous when he is suffering, my imagination, which is animated in the open air and under the trees, languishes and dies in a room and under the rafters of a ceiling. I've often regretted that dryads did not exist. It would most assuredly have been amongst them that I should have found the object of my attachment. Other domestic disturbances occurred at the same time to increase my annoyance. Madame Levasseur, while paying me the most effusive compliments, was doing her utmost to alienate her daughter from me. I received letters from my old neighbourhood, in which I was informed that the worthy old woman, without my knowledge, had contracted debts in the name of Thérèse, who knew it, but said nothing to me about it. That I had to pay them annoyed me much less than their having been kept a secret from me. How could she, from whom I had never kept a secret, keep one from me? Can one conceal anything from those whom one loves? The Holbachian clique, finding that I never went to Paris, began to be seriously afraid that I was comfortable in the country, and that I should be foolish enough to remain there. Then began those intrigues, the object of which was to get me back, indirectly, to the city. Diderot, who did not want to show himself so soon, began by detaching Delaire from me, whom I had made acquainted with him, and who received and handed on to me the impressions which Diderot desired to give him, without perceiving their real purpose. Everything seemed in league to tear me from my delightful and foolish reveries. Before I had recovered from my attack of illness, I received a copy of the poem on the destruction of Lisbon, which I supposed was sent to me by the author. This put me under the obligation of writing to him and saying something about his composition. This I did in a letter which was printed a long time afterwards, without my consent, as will be mentioned later. Surprised to hear this poor man, overwhelmed, so to speak, by fame and prosperity, declaim bitterly against the miseries of this life, and declare everything to be bad, I formed the senseless plan of bringing him to himself again, and proving to him that everything was good. Voltaire, while always appearing to believe in God, has never really believed in anything but the devil, since his pretended God is nothing but a malicious being, who, according to him, finds no pleasure except in doing injury. The absurdity of this doctrine, which is obvious, is particularly revolting in a man loaded with blessings of every kind, who, from the bosom of happiness, endeavours to reduce his fellows to despair by the fearful and cruel picture of all the calamities from which he is himself exempt. I, who had a better right to count and weigh the evils of human life, examined them impartially, and proved to him that Providence is acquitted of responsibility in regard to every single one, and that they all have their origin in man's abuse of his faculties, rather than in the nature of things themselves. I treated him in this letter with all possible regard, consideration, delicacy, and I venture to say respect. But as I knew how easily his self-love was irritated, I did not send the letter to himself, but to Dr. Tronchin, his physician and friend, with full authority to deliver or suppress it, whichever he thought best. Tronchin gave him the letter. Voltaire, in reply, wrote me a few lines to the effect that, as he was ill and also nurse to someone else, he would defer his answer to another occasion, and said not a word about the subject. Tronchin, who sent this letter to me, enclosed it in one from himself, in which he expressed little esteem for the person who had handed it to him. I have never published, or even shown, these two letters, since I am not fond of making a show of such petty triumphs. The originals will be found in my collection, Bundle A, numbers 20 and 21. Since then, Voltaire has published the answer which he promised me, but never sent. It is no other than the romance of Candide, of which I cannot speak because I have not read it. All these distractions ought to have cured me completely of my fantastic amours, and they were perhaps a means offered me by heaven to prevent their fatal consequences. But my unlucky star was in the ascendant, and I had scarcely begun to go out again, when my heart, my head, and my feet again took the same paths. I say the same in certain respects, for my ideas, a little less exalted, this time remained upon earth, but made so dainty a selection of everything amiable that could be found, that this selection was hardly less chimerical than the imaginary world which I had abandoned. I represented to myself love and friendship, the two idols of my heart, under the most enchanting forms. I took delight in adorning them with all the charms of the sex which I had always adored. I imagined two female friends, rather than two of my own sex, because if an instance of such friendship is rarer, it is at the same time more amiable. I bestowed upon them two analogous but different characters, two faces, not perfect, but after my taste, lighted up by kindliness and sensibility. I made one dark, the other fair, one lively, the other gentle, one prudent, the other weak, but with so touching a weakness that virtue seemed to gain by it. I gave to one a lover whose tender friend the other was, and even something more. But I admitted no rivalry, no quarrelling, no jealousy, because it is difficult for me to imagine painful feelings, and I did not wish to mar this charming picture by anything which degraded nature. Smitten by my two charming models, I identified myself with the lover and the friend as far as it was possible for me. But I made him young and amiable, bestowing upon him, in addition, the virtues and defects which I was conscious of in myself. In order to place my characters in the midst of suitable surroundings, I successively passed in review the most beautiful spots that I had seen in the course of my travels. But I found no woodland sufficiently delightful, no landscape sufficiently moving, to satisfy my taste. The valleys of Thessaly might have satisfied me, if I had seen them. But my imagination, tired of inventing, wanted some actual spot which might serve as a foundation and create for me an illusion as to the reality of the inhabitants whom I intended to place there. For a long time I thought of the Borromean Islands in the Lago Maggiore, the charming aspect of which had delighted me, but I found too much ornament and artificiality there. However, a lake was absolutely necessary, and I ended by choosing that one, on the shores of which my heart has never ceased to wander. I fixed upon that part of the shore, where my wishes had long placed my residence, in the imaginary happiness to which my destiny has limited me. The birthplace of my poor mamma still possessed a special charm for me. The contrast of natural situations, the richness and variety of the landscape, the magnificence, the majesty of the whole, which enchants the senses, moves the heart, and elevates the soul, finally decided me, and I established my young protégés at Vevey. This was all I imagined at the moment. The remainder was not added until later. For a long time I confined myself to this indefinite plan, because it was sufficient to fill my fancy with agreeable objects, and my heart with feelings, upon which it loves to feed itself. These fictions, by their constant recurrence, at length assumed greater consistency, and fixed themselves in my brain under a definite shape. It was then that it occurred to me to give expression upon paper to some of the situations which they offered me, and, recalling all the feelings of my youth, to give play, to a certain extent, to the desire of loving, which I had never been able to satisfy, and by which I felt myself devoured. At first I scribbled upon paper a few scattered letters, without sequence or connection, and when I wanted to put them together I was often greatly embarrassed. What seems almost incredible, but is nevertheless perfectly true, is that the first two parts were written almost entirely in this manner, without my having formed any definite plan, and without my foreseeing that I should one day be tempted to make a regular work of it. Thus it will be seen that these two parts, composed too late of materials which were not shaped for the place which they occupy, are full of wordy padding, which is not found in the others. In the height of my reveries, I received a visit from Madame Dudateau, the first she had ever paid me in her life, but which, unfortunately, was not the last, as will be seen later. The Comtesse Dudateau was the daughter of the late Monsieur de Bellegarde, farmer general, and sister of Monsieur d'Épinay and Messieurs de la Live and de la Briche, both of whom were afterwards introducers of ambassadors. Certain persons whose duty it was to conduct ambassadors and foreign princes to an audience with the sovereign or head of the state. I have mentioned how I became acquainted with her before she was married. Since then I never saw her except at the festivities at La Chevrette, at Madame d'Épinay's, her sister-in-law, having frequently spent several days with her, both at Épinay and at La Chevrette. I not only found her always very amiable, but I fancied that I perceived that she was favourably disposed towards myself. She was fond of walking with me. We were both of us good walkers, and our conversation never flagged. However, I never visited her in Paris, although she asked, and even pressed me to do so. Her connection with Monsieur de Saint-Lambert, with whom I was becoming intimate, rendered her still more interesting to me. And it was in order to bring me news of this friend, who at the time was, I believe, at Manon, that she came to the Hermitage. This visit somewhat resembled the commencement of a romance. She lost her way. Her coachman had left the road at a place where it turned off, and tried to cross straight from the mill at Clairvaux to the Hermitage. Her carriage stuck in the mud at the bottom of the valley. She decided to get out and finish the journey on foot. Her thin shoes were soon wet through. She sank in the mire. Her servants had the greatest trouble imaginable to extricate her. And at last she reached the Hermitage in a pair of boots, making the air ring with shouts of laughter, in which I joined when I saw her arrive. She was obliged to change all her clothes. Thérèse provided for her wants, and I persuaded her to put aside her dignity and join us in a rustic collation, at which she greatly enjoyed herself. It was late, and she remained only a short time, but the meeting was so cheerful that she was delighted, and seemed disposed to come again. However, she did not carry out her intention until the following year, but alas, this delay was not of the least avail to protect me. I spent the autumn in an occupation which no one would suspect, that of protecting Monsieur d'Épinay's fruit. The Hermitage was the reservoir for the park of La Chevrette. There was a garden enclosed by walls, planted with espaliers and other trees, which supplied Monsieur d'Épinay with more fruit than his kitchen garden at La Chevrette, although three-quarters of it was stolen. Not to be an entirely useless guest, I undertook the management of the garden and the superintendence of the gardener. All went well until the fruit season, but in proportion as it ripened, I found that it disappeared, without knowing what became of it. The gardener assured me that the dormice ate it all. I accordingly waged war upon the dormice and destroyed a large number of them. But the fruit disappeared all the same. I kept watch so carefully that at length I discovered that the gardener himself was the chief dormouse. He lived at Montmorency and used to come from there in the evening, with his wife and children, to take away the stores of fruit which he'd put aside during the day, and which he offered for sale in the Paris market, as openly as if he'd had a garden of his own. This wretch, whom I loaded with kindnesses, whose children Thérèse clothed, and whose father, who went out begging, I almost supported, robbed us with equal ease and effrontery, since not one of us three was sufficiently watchful to put a stop to it. And in a single night he succeeded in emptying my cellar, which I found completely stripped on the following morning. As long as he only seemed to devote his attention to me, I bore it all. But as I wished to render an account of the fruit, I was obliged to denounce the thief. Madame d'Épinay asked me to pay him, discharge him, and look out for another gardener, which I did. As this rascal prowled round the Hermitage every night, armed with a large iron-tipped stick like a club, and accompanied by other vagabonds of his own sort, in order to reassure the womenfolk, who were terribly alarmed at him, I made his successors sleep at the Hermitage, and as even this failed to quiet their fears, I sent to ask Madame d'Épinay for a gun, which I gave to the gardener to keep in his room, with instructions only to make use of it in case of necessity, if an attempt was made to break open the door or scale the garden wall, and only to fire a discharge of powder, simply to frighten the thieves. These were assuredly the least measures of precaution which a man in ill health, who had to pass the winter in the midst of the forest, alone with two nervous women, could have taken for the common safety. Lastly, I procured a little dog to serve as sentinel. When Delaire came to see me during that time, I told him my story, and joined him in laughing at my military preparations. On his return to Paris, he tried in his turn to amuse Diderot with an account of them. And this was how the old Bacchian clique learned that I seriously intended to pass the winter at the Hermitage. This consistency on my part, which they could never have imagined, quite disconcerted them. And in the meantime, until they could think of some other annoyance to render my stay unpleasant, they separated from me, through Diderot, this same Delaire, who at first considered my proportions quite natural, and ended by calling them contrary to my principles and worse than ridiculous, in some letters in which he overwhelmed me with sarcasms, sufficiently biting to offend me, if I had been in the humour. At the present moment I marvel at my stupidity in not having seen, when I was writing this, that the annoyance which the old Barkians felt when they saw me go to stay in the country was chiefly due to the fact that they no longer had Madame Levasseur at hand in order to guide them in their system of intrigues at fixed places and times. This idea, which occurs to me too late, completely explains the strangeness of their conduct, which is inexplicable under any other supposition. But at that time, steeped in affectionate and tender sentiments, and susceptible of no others, I regarded his bitter sarcasms as nothing but a joke, and looked upon him as merely silly, when anyone else would have considered him a madman. Thus, those who prompted him lost their trouble on this occasion, and I passed the winter without being in the least disturbed. By dint of care and watchfulness, I succeeded so well in protecting the garden that, although the yield of fruit was almost entirely a failure this year, the result was triple that of the preceding year. I certainly spared no pains to preserve it. I even accompanied the consignments which I sent to La Chevrette and Épinay, and carried some baskets myself. I remember that Aunt and myself once carried one that was so heavy that, to avoid succumbing under the load, we were obliged to rest every dozen steps, and arrived bathed in perspiration. 1757. When the bad weather began again and I was confined to the house, I tried to resume my stay-at-home occupations, but found it impossible. I saw everywhere nothing but my two charming friends, their friend, their surroundings, the country in which they lived, the objects which my fancy created or embellished for them. I no longer belonged to myself for a single moment. My delirium never left me. After several fruitless attempts to banish all these imaginary creations from my mind, I became at last completely seduced by them, and all my efforts were thenceforth devoted to reducing them to some sort of order and coherence, in order to work them up into a kind of romance. I was chiefly embarrassed by the shame which I felt at contradicting myself so openly and so boldly, after the strict principles which I just laid down with so much noise, after the austere maxims which I had preached so strongly, after the biting invectives which I had launched against the effeminate books which breathed nothing but love and tenderness. Could anything more unexpected or more shocking be imagined than to see me all at once enroll myself with my own hand amongst the authors of those books which I had so strongly censured? I felt this inconsistency and all its force. I reproached myself with it. I blushed for it. I was vexed with myself for it. But all this was unable to bring me back to reason. Completely enthralled, I was forced to submit to the yoke at all risks, and to make up my mind to brave public opinion, except in regard to considering later whether I should decide to show my work or not. For I did not as yet suppose that I should ever determine to publish it. Having taken this resolution, I threw myself heartily into my reveries, and after repeatedly turning them over and over in my head, I at last sketched the kind of plan with the execution of which the public is acquainted. This was certainly the best advantage that could be derived from my follies. The love of the good, which has never left my heart, turned them naturally towards useful objects, which might have been productive of moral advantage. My voluptuous pictures would have lost all their grace if the gentle colouring of innocence had been wanting in them. A weak girl is an object of pity, which may be rendered interesting by love, and which is frequently not less amiable. But who can endure without indignation the sight of fashionable manners? What can be more revolting than the pride of an unfaithful wife, who, openly trampling underfoot all her duties, nevertheless claims that her husband should be deeply grateful for the favour which she grants him? Of being kind enough not to allow herself to be caught in the act? Perfect beings do not exist, the lessons which they give are too far remote from us. But that a young person, born with a heart equally tender and virtuous, while still unwedded, should allow herself to be overcome by love, and when wedded should find strength to overcome it in her turn and become virtuous again. If anyone should tell you that this picture is, on the whole, scandalous and unprofitable, he is a liar and a hypocrite. Do not listen to him. Besides morality and conjugal fidelity, which are radically connected with all social order, I had another and deeper object in view, harmony and public peace, an object greater and perhaps more important in itself, and certainly so at the moment. The storm aroused by the Encyclopédie, far from subsiding, was at that time at its height. The two parties, let loose against each other with desperate frenzy, were more like mad wolves ready to tear each other to pieces in their rage than Christians and philosophers desirous of mutually enlightening, convincing, and leading each other back into the way of truth. It may almost be said that nothing was wanting on either side but active leaders of sufficient importance for the quarrel to degenerate into civil war. And God only knows what would have been the result of a civil war waged on behalf of religion, in which the most cruel intolerance was in the main the same on both sides. A born enemy of all party spirit, I had frankly told some hard truths to both parties, to which they had paid no attention. I bethought myself of another expedient, which, in my simplicity, I considered admirable. This was to soften their mutual hatred by destroying their prejudices, and to point out to each party the merits and virtues of the other as worthy of public esteem and the respect of all mankind. This by no means sensible scheme, which assumed good faith amongst men, and which led me into the mistake with which I reproached the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, met with the success which it deserved. It entirely failed to reconcile the two parties, and only brought them together again in order to overwhelm me. Meanwhile, until experience had shown me my folly, I devoted myself to it, I ventured to say, with a zeal worthy of the motive which inspired me, and I sketched the two characters of Walmar and Julie in a state of rapture, which made me hope that I should succeed in making both amiable, and what is more, by means of each other. Satisfied with having roughly sketched my plan, I returned to the situations of detail which I'd marked out. The result of the form in which I arranged them was the two first parts of Julie, which I wrote and made a fair copy of during the winter months with indescribable pleasure, using the finest gilt-edged paper, blue and silver writing sand to dry the ink, and blue ribbon to fasten my manuscript. In short, nothing was sufficiently elegant or refined for the charming girls, with whom, like another Pygmalion, I was infatuated. Every evening, by the fireside, I read and read again these two parts to the women folk. The daughter, without saying a word, and moved to tenderness, joined her sobs to mine. The mother, finding no compliments in it, understood nothing of it, remained quiet and contented herself with repeating to me, during the intervals of silence, "That is very fine, sir." Madame d'Épinay, uneasy at knowing that I was alone in winter, in the middle of the forest, in a lonely house, frequently sent to inquire after me. I had never received such genuine proofs of her friendship, and my own feelings towards her never responded to them with greater warmth. Amongst these proofs I should be wrong to omit to state that she sent me her portrait, and asked me to tell her how she could procure mine, which had been painted by Latour and exhibited at the Salon. Nor ought I to omit another mark of her attention, which will appear laughable, but is a feature in the history of my character, by reason of the impression which it produced upon me. One day, when it was freezing very hard, I opened a parcel which she had sent, containing several things which she had undertaken to procure for me, and found in it a little under-petticoat of English flannel, which she informed me she had worn, out of which she desired me to make myself a waistcoat. The style of her note was charming, full of tenderness and simplicity. This mark of attention, which was more than friendly, appeared to me so tender, as if she'd stripped herself to clothe me, that in my emotion I kissed the note and the petticoat with tears. Thérèse thought that I'd gone mad. It is singular that, of all the marks of friendship lavished upon me by Madame d'Épinay, not one has ever moved me so much, and even since the rupture between us I have never thought of it without emotion. I kept her little note for a long time, and I should still have it in my possession, if it had not shared the fate of all my other letters of that period. Although the difficulty I had in making water gave me little rest during the winter, and for part of the time I was obliged to use probes, yet on the whole it was the most enjoyable and most quiet time that I'd spent since my arrival in France. For the 4 or 5 months during which the bad weather secured me still further from the interruptions of unexpected visitors, I enjoyed, more than I ever had or have done before or since, this independent, even, and simple life, the enjoyment of which only increased its value, without any other society than that of the two women in reality, and that of the two cousins in idea. It was at that time, especially, that I congratulated myself more and more every day upon the resolution which I'd had the good sense to take, without paying heed to the outcries of my friends, who were annoyed to see me delivered from their tyranny. And when I heard of the attempt of a madman, the attempt made by Damiens to assassinate Louis XV, when Dallaire and Madame d'Épinay informed me in their letters of the disturbance and agitation prevailing in Paris, I heartily thanked heaven for having kept me at a distance from those spectacles of horror and crime, which would only have fed and sharpened the bilious temperament which the sight of public disturbances stirred up within me. Whereas now, seeing myself surrounded by nothing but smiling and peaceful objects in my retreat, my heart was entirely given up to amiable feelings. I here record with satisfaction the course of the last peaceful moments which I have been permitted to enjoy. The spring which followed this calm winter saw the germs of the misfortunes which I have still to describe burst forth, in the series of which will be found no similar intervals in which I have had time to take breath. I think, however, that I remember that during this interval of peace, and even in the depths of my solitude, I did not remain altogether undisturbed by the Holbachians. Diderot stirred up some annoyances against me, and unless I am very much mistaken, it was during this winter that the Fils Naturel appeared, of which I shall have to speak presently. Not to mention that, for reasons which will subsequently appear, very few trustworthy records of that period have been preserved, even those which I have been permitted to keep are very inaccurate in regard to dates. Diderot never dated his letters. Madame d'Epinay and Madame Dudetot only put the day of the week, and Delaire usually did the same. When I wanted to arrange these letters in order, I was obliged to grope in the dark and to supply the omissions by uncertain dates, upon which I cannot rely. Therefore, as I am unable to fix with certainty the date of the commencement of these quarrels, I prefer to relate afterwards, in a single section, all that I can recollect about them. The return of spring had redoubled my tender frenzies, and in my erotic transports I had composed for the last parts of Julie several letters which have a flavour of the rapturous frame of mind in which I wrote them. I may mention, amongst others, that which deals with the Elysium and the walk along the shores of the lake, which, if I rightly recollect, are at the end of the fourth part. If anyone can read these two letters without feeling his heart softened and melted by the same emotion which dictated them to me, he had better shut the book. He is incapable of judging of matters of sentiment. Exactly at the same time, I had a second unexpected visit from Madame Dudetot. In the absence of her husband, who was a captain in the gendarmerie, and of her lover, who was also in the service, she had come to Aubonne, in the midst of the valley of Montmorency, where she had taken a very nice house. It was from there that she made a second excursion to the Hermitage. On this occasion she came on horseback, dressed in men's clothes. Although I am not fond of such masquerades, I was charmed with the air of romance in this particular case, and this time it was love. As it was the first and only time in my life, and its consequences have stamped it indelibly upon my recollection with terrible force, I must be permitted to enter with some detail into the matter. Madame la Comtesse Dudetot was approaching her 30th year, and was by no means handsome. Her face was pitted with smallpox, her complexion was coarse, she was short-sighted, and her eyes were rather too round. But notwithstanding, she looked young, and her features, at once lively and gentle, were attractive. She had an abundance of luxuriant black hair, which curled naturally, and reached down to her knees. Her figure was neat, and all her movements were marked by awkwardness and grace combined. Her wit was both natural and agreeable. Gaiety, light-heartedness, and simplicity were happily united in it. She overflowed with delightful sallies of wit, which were perfectly spontaneous, and which often fell from her lips involuntarily. She possessed several agreeable accomplishments, played the piano, danced well, and composed very pretty verses. As for her character, it was angelic. Gentleness of soul was the foundation of it. And with the exception of prudence and strength, all the virtues were combined in it. Above all, she was so completely to be trusted in her intercourse, and was so loyal to those with whom she associated, that even her enemies had no need to conceal themselves from her. By her enemies I mean those men, or rather those women, who hated her. For, as for herself, her heart was incapable of hatred, and I believe that this similarity of disposition greatly contributed to inspire me with passion for her. In the confidences of the most intimate friendship, I have never heard her speak ill of the absent, not even of her sister-in-law. She was unable either to disguise her thoughts from anyone, or to repress any of her feelings, and I am quite convinced that she spoke of her lover, even to her husband, as she spoke of him to her friends, acquaintances, and everybody, without distinction. Lastly, what proves unquestionably the purity and sincerity of her excellent disposition is that being subject to fits of most remarkable absence of mind, she was often guilty of the most ridiculous indiscretions, which were in the highest degree imprudent, as far as she was herself concerned, but which were never offensive to others. She had been married very young, and against her inclinations, to the Comte d'Houdetot, a man of position and a gallant soldier, but a gambler and a shuffler and a person of but few amiable qualities, whom she had never loved. She found in Monsieur de Saint-Lambert all the good qualities of her husband, together with others that were more agreeable, intellect, virtue, and talent. If one can excuse anything in the manners of the age, it is undoubtedly an attachment which is refined by its duration, honoured by its effects, and only cemented by mutual esteem. As far as I have been able to judge, she came to see me a little from her own inclination, but more from a desire to please Saint-Lambert, who had exhorted her to do so, and was right in believing that the friendship, which was beginning to be formed between us, would make this society agreeable to all three. She knew that I was aware of their relations, and, being able to speak of him to me without restraint, it was natural that she should find my society agreeable. She came, I saw her, I was intoxicated with love without an object. This intoxication enchanted my eyes, this object became centred in her. I saw my Julie in Madame d'Houdetot, and soon I saw only Madame d'Houdetot, but invested with all the perfections with which I had just adorned the idol of my heart. To complete my intoxication, she spoke to me of Saint-Lambert in the language of passionate love. Oh, contagious power of love! When I listened to her, when I found myself near her, I was seized with a delightful shivering, which I have never felt when with anyone else. When she spoke, I felt myself overcome by emotion. I imagined that I was interesting myself only in her feelings, when my own were similar. I swallowed in deep draughts the contents of the poisoned cup, of which as yet I only tasted the sweetness. At last, without either of us perceiving it, she inspired me with all those feelings for herself which she expressed for her lover. Alas, it was very late, it was very hard for me to be consumed by a passion as violent as it was unfortunate, for a woman whose heart was full of love for another. In spite of the extraordinary emotions which I had felt in her presence, I did not at first understand what had happened to me. It was not until she had left me that, when I attempted to think of Julie, I was surprised to find that I could think of nothing but Madame d'Houdetot. Then the scales fell from my eyes. I understood my misfortune. I groaned over it, but I did not foresee its results. I hesitated for a long time how I should behave towards her. As if real love left anyone sufficiently rational to be able to act in accordance with the result of such deliberations, I had not made up my mind when she came again and took me by surprise. On this occasion I understood the state of things. Shame, the companion of evil, made me speechless. I trembled before her, not venturing to open my mouth or lift my eyes. I was inexpressibly troubled, and she must have seen it. I resolved to confess it, and to leave her to guess the reason. This would be telling her the truth, plainly enough. If I had been young and attractive, and Madame d'Houdetot had shown herself weak, I should here blame her conduct. Nothing of the kind. I can only applaud and admire it. The course she took was equally generous and prudent. She could not suddenly give up my acquaintance without telling Saint-Lambert the reason, for he had himself persuaded her to visit me. This would have exposed two friends to the risk of a rupture, and perhaps of a public scandal, which she desired to avoid. She esteemed me and wished me well. She pitied my folly, and without flattering, lamented it, and endeavoured to cure me of it. She was very glad to be able to keep for herself and her lover a friend whom she valued. Nothing gave her more pleasure than to speak of the close and happy intimacy which we might form between us, as soon as I should have recovered my senses. She did not, however, altogether confine herself to these friendly exhortations, and, when necessary, did not spare the harsher reproaches which I had so well deserved. I spared myself even less. As soon as I was alone, I came to myself again. I was calmer for having spoken. Love, when it is known to her who inspires it, becomes more endurable. The energy with which I reproached myself for the love which I felt must have cured me of it, if it had been possible. I summoned to my aid all the most powerful arguments I could think of to stifle it. My moral sense, my feelings, my principles, the shame, the disloyalty, the crime, the abuse of a trust confided to me by friendship, and lastly the absurdity, at my age, of being inflamed with a most extravagant passion for one whose heart, already engaged, could neither make me any return, nor permit me to entertain the least hope. A passion, besides, which, far from having anything to gain by constancy, became more unbearable from day to day. I thought of all these. Who would believe that the last consideration, which should have added weight to all the rest, was the one which weakened their force? What scruples, said I to myself, need I entertain in regard to a folly by which I am the only sufferer? Am I a young gallant of whom Madame Dudateau should feel alarmed? Would it not be said, to judge from my conceited remorse, that my gallantry, my manner, and my personal appearance were on the way to lead her astray? Oh, poor Jean-Jacques! Love on to your heart's content, with a perfectly safe conscience, and have no fear that your sighs will ever injure Saint-Lambert. My readers have seen that I was never presuming, even in my youth. This way of thinking was in keeping with the bent of my mind. It flattered my passion. It was sufficient to make me abandon myself to it unreservedly, and even laugh at the irrelevant scruples, which I thought I had created rather out of vanity than in accordance with the dictates of reason. What a lesson for honest souls, whom vice never attacks openly, but whom it finds the means to surprise, ever hiding itself under the mask of some sophism, frequently of some virtue. Guilty without remorse, I soon became so without measure, and I beg the reader to observe how my passion followed the track of my disposition, to drag me finally into the abyss. At first it assumed a humble attitude to reassure me, and then, in order to encourage me, pushed this humility to mistrust. Madame Dudateau, without relaxing her efforts to recall me to my duty and reason, without ever flattering my folly for a moment, treated me in other respects with the greatest gentleness, and assumed towards me a tone of the tenderest friendship. This friendship would have been enough for me, I declare, if I had believed it to be sincere, but as I found it too pronounced to be true, I proceeded to get the idea into my head that love, which was from this time forth so ill-suited to my age and general appearance, had degraded me in the eyes of Madame Dudateau, that in the extravagance of her youth she only desired to amuse herself with me and my superannuated passions, that she had taken Saint-Lambert into her confidence, and that, indignation at my disloyalty having brought him over to her views, there was an understanding between them to turn my head completely, and then to laugh at me. This folly, which had caused me at 26 years of age to make a fool of myself with Madame de Larnage, whom I did not know, would have been excusable in me at the age of 45, in the case of Madame Dudateau, if I had not known that she and her lover were both too honourable to indulge in so cruel an amusement. Madame Dudateau continued to pay me visits, which I was not slow to return. Like myself, she was fond of walking. We took long walks in an enchanted country. Content to love her, and to venture to declare it, my situation would have been most delightful, had not my extravagant folly completely destroyed its charm. At first she utterly failed to understand the silly petulance with which I received her tenderness. But my heart, which has ever been incapable of concealing any of its emotions, did not long leave her in ignorance of my suspicions. She tried to treat them as a joke, but this expedient was unsuccessful. Violent attacks of rage would have been the result. She accordingly altered her tone. Her compassionate gentleness remained unshaken. She reproached me in a manner which cut me to the heart. She exhibited, in regard to my unjust apprehensions, an uneasiness which I abused. I demanded proof that she was not laughing at me. She saw that there was no other way of reassuring me. I became pressing. The matter was a delicate one. It is surprising, it is perhaps unique, that a woman who had ventured to go so far as to hesitate should have got out of the affair so well. She refused me nothing that the most tender friendship could grant. She granted nothing that could expose her to the charge of infidelity, and I had the humiliation of seeing that the flames, which the slightest favours on her part kindled in my heart, never threw the slightest spark into her own. I have said somewhere that one must grant nothing to the senses when one desires to refuse them something. In order to see how this maxim was falsified in the case of Madame Dudeteau, and how completely she was justified in her self-dependence, it will be necessary to enter into the details of our long and frequent tête-à-têtes, and to describe them in all their liveliness during the 4 months which we spent together, in the course of an intimacy almost unprecedented between two friends of opposite sexes, who confine themselves within the limits beyond which we never went. Ah, if it was so late before I felt true love, my heart and senses paid dearly for the arrears. How great are the transports one must feel by the side of a dearly loved object of affection who returns our love, when even a love which is unrequited can inspire those which it does. But I am wrong in speaking of an unrequited love. To some extent mine was returned. It was equal on both sides, although it was not mutual. We were both intoxicated with love, she for her lover, I for her. Our sighs, our delightful tears, mingled together. Tender confidants, our feelings were so closely connected that it was impossible that they should not unite in something. And yet, amidst this dangerous intoxication, she never forgot herself for a moment. As for myself, I protest, I swear that if, sometimes carried away by my senses, I attempted to make her unfaithful, I never truly desired it. The vehemence of my passion of itself kept it within bounds. The duty of self-denial had exalted my soul. The splendour of all the virtues adorned in my eyes, the idol of my heart. To have soiled its divine image would have been its annihilation. I might have committed the crime. It has been committed 100 times in my heart. But to degrade my Sophie, could that ever have been possible? No, no. I told her so myself 100 times. Had it been in my power to satisfy myself, had she abandoned herself to me of her own accord, I should, except in a few brief moments of delirium, have refused to be happy at such a cost. I loved her too dearly to desire to possess her. It is nearly a league from the Hermitage to Aubonne. On my frequent visits I sometimes passed the night there. One bright moonlight evening, after having supped together, we went for a walk in the garden. At the bottom of this garden there was a rather large copse, through which we made our way to a pretty grove, adorned with a cascade, the idea of which she had carried out at my suggestion. Immortal souvenir of innocence and bliss. It was in this grove that, seated by her side on a grassy bank, under an acacia in full bloom, I found, to express the feelings of my heart, language that was really worthy of them. For the first and only time in my life I was sublime, if one may so call all the amiability and seductive charm that the tenderest and most ardent love can inspire in a man's heart. What intoxicating tears I shed upon her knees, what tears I caused her to shed in spite of herself. At last, in an involuntary transport, she exclaimed, "Never, no, never was a man so amiable. Never did a lover love like you. But your friend Saint-Lambert is listening to us. My heart cannot love twice. I sighed and was silent. I embraced her. What an embrace! But that was all. For 6 months she had lived alone, that is to say, far from her lover and her husband. During 3 of these months I saw her nearly every day, and love was always with us. We had supped alone. We were alone in a grove beneath the light of the moon, and after 2 hours of the liveliest and tenderest conversation, she left, in the middle of the night, this grove and the arms of her friend, as free from guilt, as pure in heart and person as she had entered it. Reader, weigh all these circumstances. I will add no more. At the same time, let no one imagine that on this occasion my feelings left me as undisturbed as in the presence of Thérèse or Mamma. I have already said that this time it was love, love in all its force and in all its frenzy. I will not describe the agitation, the shivering, the palpitation, the convulsive movements, or the faintness of the heart which I felt continually. The reader can judge of it from the impression which her image alone produced upon me. I have said that it was a considerable distance from the Hermitage to Aubon. I went past the hills of Andilly, which are delightful. As I walked, I dreamed of her whom I was going to see, of the tender reception, of the kiss which awaited me on my arrival. This kiss alone, this fatal kiss, even before I received it, inflamed my blood to such a degree that I felt dizzy, my eyes swam, I was blinded. My trembling knees could no longer support.